The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Congestive heart failure is presented by Dr. Martin Burke.
Okay. Quick overview on heart failure. Very important in the syllabus. I've added a lot of the guidelines. I'm not going to drone on about the guidelines. I put them in there more for your review and accessibility. The thing to remember about the boards is that they're going to more likely test you on class 1 indications and class 3 indications. And they're not going to get into the weeds on the class 2A and 2B. I don't think the 2Bs would be very interesting. They're too controversial. You guys already know my disclosures. Okay, so heart failure. It's an impaired cardiac pumping such that the heart is unable to meet the amount of blood necessary to have metabolic demands met by the human body. It's not a disease. There are diseases that cause heart failure, but it's more a syndrome, often associated with longstanding hypertension and coronary disease. So the most common etiology for heart failure in the developed world is hypertension and coronary disease. Heart failure can be divided into reduced ejection fraction and preserved ejection fraction. I'm sure all of your EMR wonks have told you you need to document whether or not it's reduced ejection fraction or preserved ejection fraction because they have all different DRGs related to this. So I'm probably telling you something that you already do every day in your clinic notes. Hopefully you do. I do think that high output cardiac failure is it's at least one question on the internal medicine boards, and it's usually includes a case, and then it might have differentials in the answers, of which they are all listed right here. So thiamine deficiency, which is known as wet beriberi, Paget's disease, and hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasias, as well as AV fistula, are all within the same type of pathophysiology for high output cardiac failure. Thyrotoxicosis is a classic internal medicine test question for high output cardiac failure. Means-Learmann valvular murmur associated with thyrotoxicosis, fever, and obviously the endocrine measurements for thyrotoxicosis. Septic shock is just the most common form that you see clinically of high output cardiac failure. And this is also due to, obviously, dilatation and disruption of the capillary beds. So obviously a very similar pathophysiology to Paget's and large AV fistula. And then don't forget anemia as a cause for high output cardiac failure. And a lot of this is probably perpetuated by the lack of oxygen carrying capacity and therefore demand issues. It's a clinical diagnosis. It's not something that's diagnosed by biomarker. Okay, I've always said this, but the guidelines do not necessarily support that. And I'll show you in a second what I mean by that. But looking at levels of BNP and troponin are not going to get you over the goal line on diagnosing congestive heart failure, at least in terms of its etiology, whereas physical examination and history are going to help you out the most. Specifically, jugular venous distension, rails, and S3 plus or minus symptoms, and to an extent, arrhythmia, which is either atrial or ventricular. You've heard a lot about arrhythmia, cardiomyopathies, and then obviously sudden cardiac death as a manifestation of congestive heart failure. CHF is a prevalent and clinical problem of which the most common cause, again, is ischemic heart disease. CHF treatments range from pharma to devices to orthotopic heart transplantation. So what are some of the clinical historical signs that you'll find with patients who present with congestive heart failure? And this is mostly in patients who have reduced ejection fraction congestive heart failure, not preserved or diastolic dysfunction heart failure. So agitation, pale or cyanotic, so low perfusion states, cold and clammy skin, severe dyspnea, tachypnea, and then the final stage is pink frothy sputum, where you have such congestion that it's coming out of your mouth. When you think about edema, pulmonary edema is just a correlate to edema. So if you look at edema in the legs or anywhere in the body, it can be caused by four physiologic mechanisms. Number one, increased hydrostatic pressure. Number two, low oncotic pressure. Number three, poor lymphatic drainage. And number four, trauma. So when you're looking at somebody, you're getting a historical feature of edema, whether it's in the legs, the abdomen, or in the lungs, you need to take into account those four pathophysiologic states, and there may be a lead in the description of the case that gives you that type of an understanding. In other words, the patient was in a car accident and hit the steering wheel with their chest, you may want to think about pulmonary contusion and that is a cause for pulmonary edema. But then there's also the cardiac contusion that can cause ischemia and increased diastolic pressure and fall. And so you're going to have to delve through those issues. But it's always easier to help diagnostically get to the question when you take into account the physiology of edema. And they might give you some clues in the history. And that's where you want to look at it first. When you're taking the test, read the question first, then go back and start nitpicking through the case. A big trick in board examinations is to give you this really long and elaborate case description and then a question that you might easily answer, which is being able to skim through the case saves you more time for the other questions. I'll throw in a little tidbit here and there. All right, so factors affecting cardiac output, it's mainly heart rate and stroke volume, but don't forget about preload. And once again, when you look at the anemic patient, afterload has a big feature on decreasing cardiac output because it pushes back preload. And, you know, essentially afterload pushing back on the heart and then pushing back on the veins and decreasing venous return. So essentially, when you're looking at cardiac output, the biggest effect on cardiac output is heart rate. Heart rate has the highest effect because it's the thing that is most easily adjusted in the physiologic milieu of the human body. And you can see how this can adjust liters per minute very quickly, even if you have the same stroke volume. But only up to a point. With excessive high heart rates, diastolic filling, time begins to fall, thus causing stroke volume and furthermore cardiac output to fall. And this is illustrated in this slide right here, demonstrating the importance of venous return and cardiac output. If you're going to be tested on this, it's going to be using these two equations. Venous return equals cardiac output, and cardiac output equals heart rate times stroke volume. And they'll give you these clues within the question. And this just demonstrates how end-diastolic volume or preload can be affected later on in higher heart rate, where you get this drop-off of stroke volume and because the preload is decreased. They're also going to clinically test your assessments of stages of congestive heart failure based on clinical presentation. Most of the boards rely heavily on history and physical examination to test your clinical acumen. They don't get into tests so much. We'll talk tests in my next lecture. But it's going to be a lot that's predicated on this one slide. I think you should familiarize yourself with this before you go into the boards. mainly because it talks mostly about low perfusion physical findings and then matches them to clinical historical findings. And so what you see here is low perfusion at rest versus congestion at rest. So this is, you know, in a usually a class or a stage C, stage D presentation of heart failure. And so what you're seeing here is warm and dry. Usually that's a good perfusion state and with very little congestion at rest. And then as you move through the quadrangle here, you see that you have warm and wet as a presentation, and that's where the patient has good perfusion but has some congestion. Cold and dry is where the patient has very poor perfusion, and this is a very low perfusion state where the patient's usually not been eating, has a lot of cardiocachexia, has already been diuresed, or because they're not really taking any salt and water, they don't have any volume overload, but they have a very low state. The two on the bottom are medical emergencies and require a very keen amount of attention in an intensive care unit, and usually involves placing balloon pumps for perfusion and also very tight fluid management, especially in the fourth one. You're going to have inotropes involved in these patients on the bottom, whereas on the top you have a little bit more ability to manage the patients in a more conservative manner, less invasive Swan monitoring, IV diuretics, and reinitiation of their drugs, plus or minus inotropes. More than likely, with the warm patients, you're not going to have to introduce inotropes, but you may, in the one case where the patients have low perfusion that's manifested by a pre-renal azotemic state and therefore some degree of problem with urinary output. Okay, so you're going to be really testing on the 2013 guidelines during this exam cycle. This is prime guideline. By now, they're definitely in the examination, these guidelines. So I already mentioned to focus on the class one and the class three in your understanding. Don't, you know, I'm not saying, you know, forget about 2A and 2B. They're obviously clinically salient more often because that's who you're really seeing in clinic. But it's easier to test on something that is class one and class three because they're more definitive in the evidence for their making them class one. That being said, the level of evidence very often for class one is not typically A. It's usually B to C, so be very careful. I think where it's a level of evidence of A and it's a class one, that's going to be the one that they want you to know, and they certainly want you to know class three. So for biomarkers, you see there's no class three, and really the biomarker you have to be most familiar with is BNP, and they look at this as ambulatory acute heart failure symptoms for diagnosis of exclusion, okay? So it's not a diagnosis of. So biomarker, don't be confused by this particular guideline where it says biomarker is a class one. It's a biomarker as a class one for diagnosis of exclusion. That's for like the patient with the contusion or patient with pneumonia. Even though BNP can be elevated, it's not going to be in these skyrocketing stages. And then the second class one is for prognosis of heart failure. So as a measure of the patient, so you get a baseline BNP, it's elevated. When they're in heart failure, you compensate them with your medical management. You get another BNP to see where they're at, and then as they're in their ambulatory state, you can use that to adjust, because precision medicine, different biomarkers in different patients with different comorbidities, such as sleep apnea, lung disease, other things that can cause false elevation of the BNP. So it's much more identified here in its exclusive capabilities and in its ability to monitor patients' progress with your medical therapy. No class three here. Okay, so if you look at for non-invasive cardiac imaging in heart failure, it's for patients with suspected acute or new onset heart failure should undergo a chest X-ray, echocardiogram, and repeat measurements of their ejection fraction from time to time, and especially if they have significant change in their clinical status. So this is something that might be brought on to a board exam. Not highly likely, but it's something that gives, it tests your ability to understand that you can actually order, a repetitive imaging type study to assess a patient's status when they have a change in their clinical signs and symptoms, and not so much as a monitor for their response to medical therapy. More importantly, if you look at the class three, this is the more likely thing that's going to be tested, is routine repeat measurement of LV function should not be performed. And it's no benefit to this within a hospitalization. For invasive evaluation, I think you should focus on the harm side of it. So routine routine invasive hemodynamic monitoring is not recommended in the normal tensive patient with acute heart failure. Very important. But if you're in the low blood pressure or low perfusion state, then it is indicated and it's probably going to be most helpful. So that's the class one. If you look at endomyocardial biopsy, it should not be performed as a routine evaluation of heart failure. And then probably the next question after that one is going to be that matching thing that I show you with the biopsy. Just kidding. All right. So recommendations for treatment of stage B heart failure. You can see that most of these are very well documented, and there's a lot of levels of evidence for stage B. And that I'll take that in comparison to class C, stage C. But really, when you look in this, the main thing to take out of this is that calcium channel blockers are harmful to patients with a low ejection fraction and in a poor heart failure state. And then if you're looking at the most important thing that you're going to be tested on over and over again on the boards is maximizing ACE inhibitors and beta blockers. And it's not just getting them on an ACE inhibitor, an ARB, or a beta blocker, but it's maximizing it to optimal levels, which is where you're going to get the blood pressure down to the systolics of 90, mainly because you want to perform as much afterload reduction as you possibly can. Maximizing the beta blockers in patients with arrhythmias, so in terms of what you might be testing on within the scope of these class one indications is, so we have the patient with the dilated cardiomyopathy, no arrhythmias, and you want to push the afterload reduction with the pure vasodilator of the ACE inhibitor or the ARB. Whereas in the contrast, the patient with atrial fibrillation and some mild dilated cardiomyopathy, or ischemic disease, where you're going to want to push up the beta blocker. And so there's this to and fro that you're always dealing with the blood pressure, and they're going to test you on that during the examination. Okay, I'm going to go over this slide in great detail, so pay attention. No, I just put this in there for your own edification. It's a horrible slide. This slide's even worse. So I'm not going to start there. I just want to point out that there's a lot of class three in this particular slide, and it's mostly around nutritional supplements. The good news is that my next slide in the syllabus kind of outlines exactly what you're going to be testing on. So if you look at the key points for medical therapy for heart failure and reduced ejection fraction, stage C, aldosterone is a class one in patients with post-MI and diabetes. So you get a case of the patient who presents after a myocardial infarction, is diabetic, and is on a beta blocker and maybe a low-dose ACE inhibitor, and the question might be, well, what would you add to their regimen to help them out? And it's the neurohormonal question that they're getting to, and this is level of evidence A. So when you look at the next step, and you'll even see this clinically in your practices where the cardiologist, the heart failure specialist, will be already adding on aldosterone even in stage B. But this is something that is in a stage C. And stage C is sort of that can't walk more than a block type reduced ejection fraction heart failure. ARB use as a first line prior to intolerance of ACE inhibitors is a class 2A. So I don't know if they'll they'll test you on the ACE inhibitor ARB differential there. Most of the test usually considers them unequal. I don't see a reason to test your knowledge on this, but just I think because it's a class 2A, they've given it a shout out in the guidelines. You may want to be careful and just know about it. We haven't really talked too much about anticoagulation during this whole session, but systemic anticoagulation is class 1 in heart failure with atrial fibrillation and at least one more risk of thromboembolism, which is usually age of 65 or greater, and unfortunately for the females in the audience, gender. More aggressive systemic anticoagulation is class 1 or 2A in symptomatic heart failure with reduced ejection fraction if they've had prior stroke or thromboembolism. So you're basically addressing in heart failure the CHADS FAST scoring system. You need to familiarize yourself with the CHADS FAST scoring system and the HAS-BLED scoring system in patients with heart failure. And in the HAS-BLED, it's very important to understand, so that indicates a high risk of bleeding. The two groups that are at highest risk for bleeding on anticoagulants and where you can have a test question that's very easily to exclude anticoagulation is in those who have a combination of liver failure, renal failure, and then the secondary is usually a combo with that is polysubstance abuse. So alcoholics and patients who are chronic drug users. So when you look at unindicated or harmful class 3 indications for reduced ejection fraction heart failure, seeing statins as a standalone therapy, that's not what they want. Even if you have ischemia as your etiology for your heart failure, you should not use this alone. It's not a benefit. That's what they're trying to say without the use of ACE inhibitor ARB and a beta blocker. Statins are very helpful and are a class 1 indication, however, for patients with known coronary artery disease and or familial risk factors. And you should familiarize yourself with EHA guidelines for application of statins based on the risk profile as a predictive analytic. So when you look at supplements, chronic ionotropes, and calcium blockade, those are the things that they're really going to try to hone in on in the heart failure patient and try to make sure that you don't use those drugs because they're very harmful. All right, any questions on reduced ejection fraction? Okay, great. So if you look at preserved ejection fraction, I think this is the more interesting part of heart failure, actually, and it's actually the most common form of heart failure, mainly because we're doing a better job with direct angioplasty. We're doing, you know, patients have been on statins now for 20, 30 years. For every 10 years you're on a statin, you decrease your risk of acute myocardial infarction and stroke by 2%. So over a 10-year period, you have a 20%, you have a 20% decrease in an event rate. So let's say, you know, I have patients now in my clinics that are 85 years old, have been on a statin since their 50s. You like look at them in clinic, you're like, you've had a 60% decrease in acute coronary syndrome and or stroke rate at this point. That's pretty amazing. I mean, I think that's like from a risk prediction standpoint, a point of reference that you know, it doesn't matter the first year you're on a statin, but 20, 30 years from then, when you're really at a high risk for these random events that I showed you on the previous lecture where the lady was just in the ER and had VF spontaneously because of a PVC on a T-wave, you basically are in better status when you have a statin in these patients because they don't have the reserve to survive that because they're already in a diastolic dysfunctive state that's usually ischemic or hypertensive in etiology. You want to think about this very carefully, and you got to be extremely aggressive with blood pressure with preserved ejection fraction. And there's new guidelines on hypertension, which I don't have time to talk about here, but just familiarize yourself with them because they're going to be tested, and it really correlates to this preserved ejection fraction management because this is the class 1 management indication. If you look at diuretics, it's the problem with most HFpEF patients is that doctors keep them on diuretics all the time. You should only use diuretics when they're in an acute congestive state and or overload state, and then take off them and try to get them to change their lifestyle, because the reason why they're overloaded is because of the salt that they had at the restaurant that they ate out the night before. And so you're just using this as sort of a booster when you need it, and that's going to help their kidneys a lot over time. And so blood pressure management, very tight, very aggressive. You need to have them get blood pressure monitors for home, and they need to be monitored. That's something that might be tested. Obviously, revascularization, and I've already mentioned atrial fibrillation. So all these things that I've highlighted in this is extremely important. I think AFib is, I don't know why it's a 2A, it's ridiculous. I think because there's no randomized clinical trials in its level of evidence C, but you will not survive very long with HFpEF and atrial fibrillation. That's how important your atrial kick is to get that diastolic push into the left ventricle that's stiff. All right, let's memorize this entire pathway here. This is very important for stage C heart failure. Essentially, this is, I only put this up there to remind me to tell you about CRT. So obviously, you should be very attentive and aggressive on the boards regarding cardiac resynchronization therapy for your patients with conduction disease. And what they're going to present is a classic heart failure patient. They're not going to give you the class stage B or the stage A. They're going to give you a stage C. Now, stage B is indicated for CRT, and they do better, and they have less progression of their heart failure. But I don't think that they're going to test you on that, because it's so important to get at least the stage C with their CRT. And what they're going to give you is a classic left bundle branch block, and they could give you that IVCD that I showed you in the last lecture, where it looks like a left bundle branch block, but it's much wider. So a left bundle branch block is usually 150 to 180 milliseconds. That patient had a QRS of about 224. So the wider the QRS, the worse the prognosis in heart failure is what you need to know. And the way that that's treated from a conductive standpoint is to resynchronize the heart by placing a left ventricular lead with an ICD and basically resynchronizing the left and right ventricle. This is a much better slide for you to review along that. This is sort of a synopsis of that crazy previous slide. And this gives you a much better understanding of end-stage C heart failure, where you're playing out in terms of indications. And the green is very important. The most important thing here is non-left bundle branch block, and less than 150 might be the trick question. So even though there's some level of evidence in the literature that 120 to 150 in women, it can be beneficial. They're not going to go there on this test. They just want to see, they want to make sure that that sweet spot, greater than 150 left bundle branch block, is getting CRT. And they might go stage B and stage C. I doubt they're going to give you a stage D heart failure patient for CRT. However, if you can get them compensated, get them off inotropes, get them off of balloon pump, you might then move on forward, and they can have dramatic results with resynchronization therapy. These are all very high level of evidence. So for the hospitalized patient, IV diuretics, you're going to hold their ACE inhibitor, ARB, or beta blocker, and you're going to have them on inotropes in a more extremic state. And what they want to test here is that when you reinstitute the medicine, you're going to start at a lower dose. You're not just going to give them back their high dose optimized medical therapy. You're just going to restart the process of introducing this. And so really the main thing that you see in this is that you want to restart the beta blocker at a low dose. You don't want to overload them right off of the inotropes, and you want to maximize. The other thing is that they're much more open to invasive monitoring in the patients who have low blood pressure. It doesn't have to be a consistent low blood pressure. It's just something that's in the medical presentation. So if they come in hypotensive, cold and dry, or cold and wet, that gives you a clinical indication and a guideline to actually monitor them with the SWAN. This is for you. This is obviously intuitive. I don't think they're going to have a lot of cardiac transplant on the IM test, maybe probably on the cardiology test. I think the main thing to take into account is, or mechanical circulatory support or LVADing. They might have it as a patient as a sidebar to their overall question that they're getting to another direction. But the main point is to familiarize yourself with the nomenclature and the fact that is, I think ionotropic support and balloon pumping would be something from an intensive care standpoint for an internist to know, and that's probably what they're going to test you on. If you're looking at transcatheter interventional treatment, obviously revascularization and a heart failure standpoint, because that's the most common, is really what's guided here. But what you're noticing is that there's not very many class one indications here other than CABG or percutaneous intervention for patients in heart failure who are on guideline-based medicines and directed medical therapy and who have symptoms. Symptoms are always going to drive the boards. They want you to treat symptoms. They don't want you to just, because when you do something to somebody, you can make them feel worse if they don't have a symptom. This is a nice, I just put this into your syllabus so that you can look it over right before the test and, just kind of familiarize yourself with some of this stuff. It's actually pretty organized and it gives you a few necessary tidbits that will help you through in a pinch during a high-stakes examination. Recommendations for hospital discharge, I doubt, are going to be on the test, but I think it just gets into the integrative type medical management and the importance of having clear follow-up after hospitalization for the heart failure patient, because this is the number one readmission DRG, and so they're really trying to push this in the guidelines so that there's a systematic approach to patients after their heart failure admission so that you get to the point where they're not readmitted. And I'll stop there.